Well, one more speaker. This is going to be Tom Tunstall. Thomas, you are between us and lunch. He is a senior research director in the Institute for Economic Development at UT San Antonio. All right. You should be all set up there. Yeah, there we go. Good.
All right. I was going to try and walk here. Can I borrow that microphone?
Do you want some help with that?
I just... Hello? Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'll just hold it because I'm going to turn my head a lot and it'll make it difficult to navigate. Well, I want to thank the task force for the opportunity to speak here, especially for the opportunity to take an extra 45 minutes to go over my presentation. Actually, I have no illusions about the fact that the fellow standing between you and lunch may not be the most popular guy in the room, so we'll try to keep the, in fact, we will keep this within parameters. A little background on the Institute for Economic Development at UT San Antonio. We actually have about 11 programs focused on various aspects of economic development in a region that covers roughly South Texas, stretching from El Paso to Corpus Christi. We work with small businesses in that area, but we also work with community leaders with through the Rural Business Program. That network extends actually into South America, into Mexico. My group does the research. We perform economic impact studies, but also community development studies, EB-5 immigrant investor analysis. And the topics not only include the Eagle Ford Shale, but we've done a study on the Cline Shale out in West Texas. We're getting ready to do a study on Argentina's shale as they're ramping up their prospects there. The San Antonio Missions targeted industry recruitment working with EDS. In fact, there are over 600 economic development corporations in Texas, and we work with a lot of those, as well as government at all levels, businesses, associations. I'd like to describe the role of the Institute with a quote from Yogi Berra, who said that in theory there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. So we try to bridge that academic or that theoretical side over at UTSA with the real world, with the policymaking world. Our research hopefully is read not just by academics, but by policymakers and practitioners, and that it enables them to better plan for the future. And then another quote that kind of describes where we are, it seems like, with this oil and gas boom that reminds us of others but may not be exactly the same. It's from Mark Twain, who said that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And then one other comment I have to make, especially in front of the TAMS group here, is where Texas stands regarding Tier 1 universities as defined by membership in the AAU. And it's interesting to note that California has 9 Tier 1 universities, 6 of which are in the University of California system. We have one Tier 1 university in the UT system. That's UT here in Austin, Rice University, Texas A&M. And that's where the list ends. We have 3. New York, with far fewer people than Texas, 19 million people, has 6 Tier 1 universities, and we probably should have 7 or 8 based on population. So hopefully the initiative, they are not members of the AAU, and that is the gold standard. That's the criteria for this list. So, yes, and if you included the Carnegie intensive research, that would the list would expand much larger. So, yeah, University of Houston folks beat me up all the time about that. And I tell them, as soon as somebody besides the University of Houston tells me that they're Tier 1, I'll believe it. All right. A lot of you, we've seen this map before, so I'm not going to belabor it. You can actually see the Eagle Ford activity from space. It's not just the flaring, but the rigs operate 24/7, so you can see it from space. The region that we looked at in terms of analysis for the Eagle Ford is a little different than the Railroad Commission defines the region. We looked at the counties in green where we see the most active drilling. The ones in orange where there's no drilling occurring, but they're seeing a lot of economic impact anyway. And then the ones in blue are usually in the Railroad Commission's definition of the Eagle Ford, but were not included in the scope of our studies. And we've done 4 of these impact studies to date. Like I said, we've done one on the Cline Shale out in West Texas. We'll be doing one on Argentina. And we've also taken a look at Mexico and their shale prospects. You can see how the drilling permits in the Eagle Ford peaked in 2014. They fell off significantly last year. This year, they're probably on track to hit maybe 1,000 permits this year. They're good for 2 years at a time. You can see natural gas production last year peaked just short of 6 billion cubic feet per day. As of June, it's about 5.2 billion cubic feet per day, about the second or third largest gas field in the U.S. right now after the Marcellus and the Permian. Oil production in the Eagle Ford peaked out last year about 1.1 million barrels per day. If you include condensate in the numbers through June, and these are daily production numbers, and condensate essentially is an ultra-light crude oil, the Eagle Ford is still producing over 1 million barrels per day. So even with the rig counts down from as high as 260 at its peak down to about 40 rigs, they're still producing quite a lot of oil and condensate. So a question I'll get asked a lot is, well, how much oil and condensate has the Eagle Ford Shale produced today? And the answer is just shy of 1.9 billion barrels, with an estimated 10 to 12 billion barrels of recoverable oil and condensate in the Eagle Ford. So there's a lot of life left there in terms of oil and gas production in the Permian. They're really just getting started. Pioneer has said that there are something like 12 Eagle Fords in the Permian Basin, so they'll be producing oil and gas for decades to come. What's been interesting about the unconventional oil and gas boom here in the U.S. is the way it's confounded forecasters. And I'll talk a little bit about forecasting a little later, but the heavier lines are and the blue lines are essentially older EIA, Energy Information Administration forecasts. And you can see, compared to the red line, which is actual production of U.S. crude oil, how they've had to continue to revise their forecasts upward because no one expected all of this oil and gas to be produced in the U.S. We thought production had peaked in the 70s. U.S. oil production, you can see here, has bounced back. We're not quite at the record that was set in 1970. For a brief period of time, the U.S. actually produced 10 million barrels of oil per day. I think we're about 9.3 million barrels per day right now. Texas is producing more oil than it has in 30 years. And so with regard to theories about peak oil, where we thought production would peak in the 70s, the theory proffered by King Hubbert back in 1956, instead, what we thought was peak oil in the late 70s actually was sort of a bump in the road, and since then, worldwide oil production is now at or near record levels, especially with OPEC producing, it seems like, as much as they can. And I don't want to leave natural gas out. The U.S. is producing more natural gas than we ever have, over 27 trillion cubic feet annually. And so, in a sense, what OPEC had tried to do with the shale producers, in essence, by continuing to produce, making the decision in November 2014 not to cut back production, it's sort of backfired in a way. The shale producers have been impacted, but they've proven surprisingly resilient. And as a result, more of OPEC's own members seem to be feeling the heat from the downturn in oil prices that has come about as a result of their decision not to cut back on production. One of the reasons these unconventional techniques were developed here and not somewhere else has to do with the way the oil and gas industry is structured in Texas. In most countries, in Russia, for example, it only takes four producers to get to 75% of their oil production. In a lot of countries, it only takes one company to get to 100%. Brazil, Iran, for example. In the U.S., it takes 77 producers to get to 75% of the oil and gas production. There's just a lot more competition here, more innovation, and that's why those techniques were pioneered here and not somewhere else. And that's why, despite the fact that there's shale oil and gas all over the world, the U.S. currently is still the only place that any significant shale oil and gas production is occurring. As I mentioned, we have done an early study on Mexico, on their shale. Sorry about that. Because the Eagle Ford actually, it goes by other names when it crosses the border, but there is shale in northern Mexico. Mexico has a lot of other conventional opportunities, deep water, for example, which hasn't really been tapped. So I don't know how soon they'll be trying to tap into their shale oil and gas reserves. But it's remarkable to note that if we go back to that NASA night shot, you see all this activity in Texas, and there's nothing occurring in Mexico. They, with Pemex as being the monopoly oil company, they didn't have the wherewithal to go after the shale reserves. As you know, Mexico has undertaken energy reform, and Pemex, their role will change over time. But it's a good thing that Mexico has undertaken energy reform. Their oil production actually peaked in 2004 and has been declining steadily since then. They already import in excess of 1 trillion cubic feet of natural gas from the U.S. annually. And had they not undertaken energy reform, they might have been looking at importing oil in the near future as well. So with regard to Mexico, on the other side of the border, we think that the longer-term study that we'll be undertaking will look at implications of upstream, midstream, the rulemaking process, infrastructure issues. Security is going to be an issue. And then Pemex, which was the de facto regulatory body in Mexico for 76 years, is not just going away. And so we'll be interested to see what their role is in the new environment. We think that they'll focus on conventional and deep water, and much the way the development occurred in Texas and the U.S., the smaller E&P companies will go after the shale in Mexico. But we'll see how that goes. Let's see. I'm going to skip over some of these slides just to kind of highlight the economic impacts. In 2013, which was the last time we had done a study on Eagle Ford, although we think the numbers were similar for 2014, it wasn't until November of 2014 that OPEC made their decision not to cut back production. So that year, we saw $87 billion of economic output, supporting about 154,000 full-time jobs, and significant impacts to salaries and benefits, gross regional product, state oil and gas revenues, the rainy day fund. Was very flush for a while because of the severance taxes. For 2023, we had estimated that that number, the impact, would reach $137 billion, but that was before the price of oil tanked. Scenarios at the time, the lowest scenario that the EIA had for oil prices was $65 a barrel, which obviously turned out to be wrong. Oil fell much farther than that. But at that price, we estimate about $48 to $68 billion in economic impact, supporting instead of 200,000 full-time jobs, something more like 72,000 to 100,000 full-time jobs. One of the reasons this new environment is so interesting has to do with the way the business models have changed. The oil and gas industry started in the 1850s with onshore activities, and that was the case for about a century, and then in the 1950s, they started energy companies started going after shallow water. And then the deep water platforms have really just sort of emerged in the past few decades. And that is where most of the majors, most of where their business models are right now. They build these hugely expensive platforms costing hundreds of millions of dollars, and they may take 10 years before they produce their first barrel of oil. The shale producers, on the other hand, are completing wells for they used to be $10 to $12 million. Now it's more like $6 to $8 million, and instead of 40 to 45 days, they can complete a well in 10 to 15 days. So it's a much faster, much more drilling-intensive process, and so the economic models that they operate under are much different than where the conventional oil companies are these days. They're using more technology increasingly. This is at the top of one of the rigs. And this is a schematic from North Dakota where in this set of wells that they're going to complete, they're using one pond for water, limited road access, and they're going to drill 96 wells in sequence. So they're essentially trying to turn it more into a manufacturing process as opposed to a traditional log-heading process. Some of the ways the Eagle Ford has changed over the years has to do with the rail infrastructure that's been put in place, and this hopefully will serve to foster the development of other types of industry, not just the oil and gas industry. And that's where the community sustainability issues that we talk about come into play. But just to give you an example of how the area has been transformed, I'm going to show you the rail spur here down near Cotulla, halfway between San Antonio and Laredo. 5 years ago, it was essentially an abandoned rail spur. You had to use a metal detector if you wanted to find any of the rails. Now it looks like this. They're bringing in sand, barite, where there's not pipeline infrastructure in place. They're taking out crude oil. And so it's literally transformed that area near Cotulla, and this is the sort of transformation that's occurred in various places throughout the Eagle Ford area. Corpus has been significantly impacted. In fact, even with the downturn, because of all the activity, a lot of it associated with manufacturing because of the low-cost natural gas here in the U.S., they've hardly really skipped a beat in terms of economic development. They have literally billions and billions of dollars of projects either associated with export, manufacturing, or other types of activity, refining associated with energy. And so I mentioned predictions and the treachery of trying to do that. And, you know, as economists, we often can't help ourselves. I'm constantly asked about predictions with regard to the price of oil, for example. This is a good one from one of Rockefeller's old partners back in 1885, who apparently didn't think that oil would be discovered outside the state of Pennsylvania and said, "I will drink every gallon of oil produced west of the Mississippi." And then this one from T. Boone, who doesn't always bat 1,000 either. In 2005, he said that global oil production would peak at 84 million barrels per day. But as I mentioned, we're actually now at record levels. In 2013, oil production in the U.S. crossed the 90 million, worldwide, I'm sorry, crossed the 90 million barrel per day mark and is somewhere, I think, at around 93 million barrels right now. And then my oil price prediction Hall of Fame, from people who I knew who they had said this, but I couldn't find them. I went back to look for them on the internet, and it never forgets anything. Folks that said that the price of oil would never, ever go below $100 a barrel ever again. And so we've watched the price of oil drop, needless to say. It's interesting to note how forecasters kind of are all over the board with regard to this is historical pricing, this is where they think it will be depending on who's doing the forecasting. And the ranges are quite wide, as you can see. And oil inventories continue to be an issue. We've seen some indication that maybe the oil inventories are cresting and that they may start to fall. And that's one of the reasons oil is sort of back up around $50 a barrel right now. We'll see how that goes. It seems like every time we hear that oil inventories are dropping, we get surprised a couple of weeks later and find out, oh, we have more than we thought. So, again, we'll have to kind of see how that goes. And this is the sort of quote that always drives me crazy. This is from the Angolan Minister of Finance just about a year ago in October, who said the oil price drop came as a surprise that captured my country in a state in which we were not sufficiently diversified. That's a theme that we constantly work with the communities in South and West Texas on, is about thinking about how to diversify their economy in the event, you know, 3 or 4 years ago we were saying, it, you know, this might not last forever. In fact, if it does last forever this time, it'll be the first time it ever happened. So we've certainly seen the drop that we figured was coming sooner or later. And as an example, hotel revenues have been down significantly. But what's been interesting is that despite the fact that revenues are down from their peak, you know, 5 years ago, as we worked with these communities in South Texas, they were losing population. But their tax revenues now are still higher than they were before the boom started. So in a lot of ways, they're still better off. And if they use that money to put in infrastructure or form the foundation for other types of business, they're actually better off. And there are some specific examples of that I can cite. As I mentioned, we've encouraged them to think about the communities, to think about diversifying their economies, whether it's rediscovering their community's history, using mixed-use zoning to help revitalize downtowns. This slide, I'm going to skip over a couple of these. But just that infrastructure foundation that I mentioned in terms of better roads, hospitals, K-12 education. If you want families to move to your community, you're going to have to be thinking about the quality of the local schools and the aesthetics. And some examples of communities that have been really successful are Gonzales, birthplace of the Texas Revolution, Carnes City. They're revitalizing their downtown. Pleasanton, birthplace of the cowboy. Cotulla, it's actually becoming a free trade zone. And they've got some interesting ideas. They're located on I-35 and have some opportunity to siphon off some traffic at Late Laredo, which is very, very congested. And then South Texas is also a good place, as it turns out, to grow olive trees and produce olive oil. And we're seeing more and more of that occurring. In addition to hunting, ranches are generating income from wildlife photography as well. So just some examples of diversification. Quality of life we often talk about. I thought I would put together a list of sort of menu items. It means different things to different people, but this makes it a little less abstract. And so to borrow another quote from Yogi Berra, the future ain't what it used to be. And it was more fun to be in Texas, I agree, when oil was $100 a barrel than it is at $40 or $45. But I wanted to take just these last couple slides to kind of have a little fun with the fact that we are in Texas. And I think for a lot of us, there's no place we'd rather be. This is from a historian at Texas State University. I wasn't surprised to find out that more books had been written about Texas than any other state, but he claims that more books have been written about Texas than all of the other states combined. And then I've got some maps here just to kind of show how prominently Texas figures in the psyche of people across the world. This empty map was given to a group of Brits. So they were asked to fill in the states of the U.S., now, they had some trouble with various parts of the country, but they always knew where Texas was. The Midwest in particular gave them a lot of trouble.
Can we use that for our report? New Hampshire.
This next one is my favorite. They've got Oklahoma labeled as North Texas. Idaho's down there where New Mexico should be. All right, and then just a couple other quick items. I was pretty sure the F-150 was the number one selling vehicle in Texas. It is. It's also the number one selling vehicle in a lot of different states. Not California. It's not the Prius. It's actually the BMW 3 Series for California. And then it's so hot in Texas. Oh, come on. That we installed fans outside. And I have this slide up in part because Texas, a lot of people don't know this, is the number one wind energy producer in the country, by far. And those are the megawatt output indications. Let's see. And then some things you'll only see in Texas. Yeah. Down from where I'm at in San Antonio, only Texas could turn defeat into a legend and a song and a tourist attraction and a major motion picture. But in the final analysis, as a lot of us sort of feel like, you know, there's really only two states in the U.S. There's Texas, and there's not Texas. So, anyway, thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer questions as time permits.
Yeah, we got a little time for questions. Anybody? They're all thinking about the question. Here we go. Good.
So what do you still don't know?
Oh,
what do you still don't
know? That's about anything in particular? There's a lot of stuff we don't know.
Relative to shale production, you showed a lot of positive things about it. What are some of the negatives?
Well, one thing that hasn't been studied as extensively as we would like are things like air quality, for example. San Antonio specifically was concerned about whether, you know, a lot of you may or may not know this, San Antonio is very close to, well, they're technically in non-attainment, and so pretty soon, if that doesn't change, they're going to have to, when it comes time to get the car inspected, have the emissions checked as well, which currently is not the case. There was concern that activity in the Eagle Ford might be affecting that non-attainment status, and as the winds blow in. Actually, what the studies so far have found out, at least with regard to San Antonio, is that the development occurring really on the northwest side is what's causing the non-attainment issues. But certainly we'd like to see more air quality monitors in South Texas to better understand what's going on there. Water issues are always a concern. We're curious about whether it's interesting to note how water pricing is being analyzed more extensively because we tend to treat a lot of natural capital and ecosystem services as essentially free, and they're not free or costless, and so we'd like to better understand some of those things. Certainly there are a lot of we're curious about how the experience in the U.S. impacts other countries. One of the things I found that was interesting when we visited Argentina recently was how many questions with regard to environmental issues we got, because their Neuquén province is about to undergo probably a similar transformation to shale fields here in the U.S. So it'll be interesting to see what we learn from the experience in other countries. Mexico will eventually get to shale production, but they're a ways off from that happening.
So one of the things you pointed out that with some of these communities you're encouraging diversification, but it seems a little flippant, perhaps, if I may say, to suggest that, because the ramp up was so rapid that a lot of those communities simply couldn't respond and be able to absorb a lot of the influx, and then there was also a rapid decline afterwards, and so now they're playing catch up in a ways, I think. Terms of infrastructure and things like that. So when we say of diversification, I think there's some real external costs, as Cesar pointed out, that in terms of economics and the social elements especially, that we really have to take into consideration.
I agree. One of the things we told the communities when all of this was happening, at the time, for example, the hotels were sold out, all of the available housing was taken up, and the rents had tripled. And so we told the community leaders, you know, obviously you can't actively diversify your economies now, but you can be planning for it and be thinking about it so that when or if a downturn comes, you'll be better prepared. You'll have something potentially in the works to try to address that. And what's been interesting with the community leaders that we actively keep in touch with is that despite the downturn, and it has been rapid, the fall off in terms of local tax revenues, they've done a good job of tightening their belts. They were prepared for this eventuality in a lot of cases, not every case, but the ones that did plan ahead and were thinking about the future are much better prepared to avoid, and we were really concerned about this, the resource curse, to try and avoid that potential. And a lot of the communities, specifically some of the ones I mentioned, have sort of stepped up to the challenge and have been successful at doing so.
This is a question slash comment. When we're dealing with transportation issues, the life cycle to develop a transportation project is not measured in years. It's measured in decades. And so one of the realities that we had with the most recent boom is that it happened so quickly. And I think one thing that I would like to see in just about every economic study is a relationship between the duration of the boom and how sustainable it is in terms of its ability to provide for all the things that you mentioned. Of course, I know about transportation. I'm not an expert on just about anything else. But I do know that when those two different windows are not considered, communities face harsh realities when the boom stops.
Yeah, the biggest problem is trying to predict oil prices. The best comment I heard about that was right around November of 2014, actually, a group of us were asked to brief the legislature ahead of that LED session. James LaBosse, who does work for the Texas Oil and Gas Commission, had a comment about oil prices. And he said, you know, when it comes to oil prices, there's really just two kinds of people. There's one group that doesn't know what the price of oil is going to be, and then there's only one kind of people. And so that's the problem. I mean, the EIA forecast that I mentioned, you know, their ranges, scenarios, did not account for the prospect of oil going below $65 a barrel, and yet it went down to $26 for a short period of time this year. So, you know, we just don't know. And OPEC's a real wild card. I mean, part of the problem is you never know what they're going to do. Whether they're going to cut back, whether they're going to try and drive other producers out of business, and it just makes it very difficult to plan. That's one of the reasons natural gas is one of the more interesting stories recently, because if I didn't have the chart with me, but from 2000 to 2010, natural gas prices fluctuated from $2 to $12 per 1,000 cubic feet. They were all over the board. And that made it difficult for electric utilities or manufacturers to try to plan for the use of natural gas. But now that we're producing so much of it, and most of us have forecast that it's not really going to get much above, at the worst case scenario, above $7 per 1,000 cubic feet, it makes it a lot easier for domestic and foreign companies using manufacturing companies using natural gas as a feedstock to relocate here. And so we're seeing a lot of foreign direct investment come into the U.S. because at least natural gas in the U.S. for the foreseeable future appears to be on a more predictable trajectory as opposed to oil, which, you know, it's hard to say.
You know, I hate to break this one up, but let's give our last speaker a big hand. Okay, I'm going to reverse the order a little bit of what Mary Beth gave me. Task Force members, we want to take a photo. You can see where the setup is right out here. We'll go outside for that. For everyone else, we are at the lunch break time. Hey! So we will resume at 1:15 this afternoon. So good if you get here at 1:10, grab your seat so we can really start on time. This room is going to be locked during lunch. So I see some of you with computers and what have you. If you wish to leave them in here, they should be just fine. For lunch, we're going to go into the atrium, which is just outside. So except for the task force people, you're welcome to go directly to lunch at this time. And as soon as we get our photo done, the task force members will be happy to join you. So thanks, everybody, for a great morning.